They will focus on gay marriage and the erosion of conscience clause protections on abortion and contraception. The bishops are on a collision course with the Obama administration and have formed a new Committee for Religious Liberty to chart their strategy. The bishops will not be talking about the nation's economic problems or about the sex abuse scandal that has dogged them for the past decade, particularly the case of a Missouri bishop who was indicted for allegedly failing to report child abuse. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
The head of the charity linked to the Penn State sex abuse scandal has resigned. Jack Rakovitz was CEO of the group called The Second Mile. It was founded by former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, who's facing multiple charges of child sexual abuse. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the U.S. Oncology Network, united in community-based cancer research to bring new cancer therapies to patients at usoncology.com.
Tuesday, WILL Radio and TV will present a full day of programs addressing the issue of hunger in central Illinois. That evening at 9, we invite you to go to willconnect.org and join an interactive online chat about the local response to hunger. Do you need help finding resources in your community? Is there something you can do to help? Hunger is silent. Help give it a voice. Be at willconnect.org Tuesday night at 9.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry that we're not going to be able to do the show we had scheduled for this first hour, talking with wine writer and importer Terry Thies. We were going to talk about his book, Reading Between the Wines, which is pretty entertaining if you're interested in wine or food. We'll see if we can get that rescheduled for another day. So instead, we've gone to the archives. We found a program that also has to do with food, so it's kind of in the same territory. This is a show that we first broadcast in 2009. We will, by the way, be here live in the second hour of the show, talking with U of I Professor of Sociology Rebecca Sandifer about a recent report, really the first comprehensive look at access to civil justice services across the country. That'll be in hour number two. So stay around with us, and we'd be happy to take your calls then. So in this first hour of Focus, remember, we'll not be taking calls. Around the world, every day, people shopping for food ask the same question. Is it fresh? And as it turns out, this is not as simple a question as it seems. This morning, we'll be talking about the idea of freshness, why it is that appeals to people, how technology has been applied to keep things fresh or make us think things are fresh, and how that has, in many ways, changed the American diet over the last century or so. And our guest for the program is Suzanne Friedberg. She is Associate Professor of Geography at Dartmouth College. At the moment, she is a non-resident fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University, and she's speaking with us from there today, from a studio there at Harvard. And we'll be talking about her book, Fresh, A Perishable History. It's published by Belknap Harvard. And in it, she looks at a number of things, among them the history of refrigeration, something that, interestingly enough, was once surprisingly controversial. And then from there, she takes a look at six common foods from the fridge, so to speak, to discover what each of those has to say about our notions of freshness. And there's a lot of really interesting things in the book. So you might want to head down to the bookstore and take a look at the book. Professor Friedberg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You know, certainly one of the things we know is that different people over time have come up with different ways to preserve food. So there is drying and salting, and people pickle things and they put it in fat and they do all kinds of things. But, you know, having said that, has freshness always been a kind of thing that has been important to people? Did they really even make that distinction between fresh and not fresh?
They did, but it didn't carry as much significance, I think, as it does today. I mean, people back in ancient times, the Romans and the Chinese, for example, attached great value to the freshest possible fish. People were going to great lengths to get live fish, you know, centuries ago. And people certainly distinguished between foods that were fresh as opposed to preserved. But it's really only since the Industrial Revolution when we've become sort of more distant from the, sort of the sources of our food that fresh has come to take on all these other sort of more complicated associations with being not just a food that's relatively new, but also a food that is supposed to be somehow more natural, somehow more healthy, somehow more pure.
Yeah. Well, you could certainly understand why freshness would become more important when people were further away from where the food is produced. But it mm-hmm. seems that much of this, the notion of freshness, how we think about it, maybe why it is we think it's important, it has to do with the fact that food producers have discovered that this is a selling point.
It is, yes. And marketing is key to understanding why freshness is so important. We advertising is... fresh is kind of the key word in the advertising business. We want everything to be fresh, even if it's not food.
And that, though it's interesting here, and it's something that you talk about right away in the book, is how defining freshness is maybe a little bit difficult. The FDA, it's their job to apparently have some kind of rules and pass on what is fresh and what is not. And there are some surprising sort of differences in terms of how things are treated, and one thing could be treated in a certain way and you could still call it fresh, but something else, if you applied the same treatment, you can't call that fresh.
Right. So, for example, the standard FDA definition says that foods can't be labeled fresh if they've been heat treated. So, for example, orange juice that's been heat treated to sterilize it and cannot be labeled fresh, but milk can be. And most frozen foods cannot be labeled fresh after they've been thawed. But most of the, for example, the tuna that we eat in the high-grade, sashimi-grade tuna that we eat in sushi restaurants, that by law has to be frozen before consumption in this country to destroy possible parasites. So, and it is, of course, you know, something we consider fresh. So it's, yes, it's fraught with exceptions.
Mm-hmm. How did the orange juice industry respond in this particular case? They perhaps would have liked to be able to pasteurize the juice and call it fresh. And what did they say when they said to the FDA, well, look, why is it you let the milk producers pasteurize the milk and call it fresh, but we can't pasteurize our orange juice and call it fresh?
Well, even within the orange juice industry, it was split between those who favored pasteurization because it was a possibility to expand their markets and obviously lengthen the shelf life, but those whose particular niche is the very, you know, the local and unpasteurized market, and they opposed it because they wanted to be the only ones who could claim that their juice was truly fresh. But that the meeting, the FDA meeting that you're referring to in the book that took place several years ago, it ended up resolving nothing. People argued for hours about this definition and then ultimately left it unchanged.
And were there other cases where other manufacturers of other products wanted to be able to do certain things to the product and yet still call it fresh?
Well, a number of years ago, and I only vaguely remember this, there was the case of the frozen chickens being labeled, being thawed and then labeled fresh. And some chicken producers opposed that. And I remember this. There was some scenes of politicians like rolling frozen chickens down hallways like as though they were bowling balls. And so this is the label is one that's been contested for some time. But it's one that... that again, yes, food manufacturers like to be able to use, even if they have to fudge it a little bit. Like you can call, even if you can't label something fresh, you can call it fresh squeezed, or you can call it fresh frozen, meaning it was frozen while it was fresh. So there again, it's like the word natural. There are ways to find it, to use it even to, within the bounds of the law.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Suzanne Friedberg. She is Associate Professor of Geography at Dartmouth College. She's also a non-resident fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. That is where she is right now, speaking to us about her recently published book, Fresh, A Perishable History. It's the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. That's the publisher. And it takes a look at our notions of freshness, why it is that's important, how it is that manufacturers have tried to use that as a selling point, how they have done that, and also in some important ways how that's changed the way we think about food and what we eat. The book is out now. If you'd like to look at it, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we do have a caller here to bring in, so why don't we just do that. Line one, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said, as a matter of fact, there's a Dr. Zora Pastor on your health, Wisconsin Public Radio, has made this comment on several occasions that Americans have come, many Americans anyway, have come to regard food as if it was medicine. You know, they don't eat something because they like it there, and many people are obsessed with, oh, this thing I'm putting in my mouth has to come from a certain source and be handled in a certain way and touched only in these ways and so on and so forth, and otherwise it's poison and I just won't have anything to do with it. How much do you think that sort of thinking has affected what you've studied and so forth? Thank you.
All right. Well, can you talk about that?
Yeah. I think... We've been through this before. The 19-teens and 1920s was a time when people had similar concerns, and when there were also a lot of when diets like raw food and fruitarian diets, diets when you were supposed to chew every mouthful for 100 times before swallowing it, were very popular. And I think it's partly has to do with, you know, sort of broader anxieties about the fast pace of, you know, how fast the world is changing and how little control we seem to have over things besides our food. But I think it's, again, also something that's heavily influenced by marketing, because obviously there are a lot of food manufacturers out there who would like us to think that whatever they're selling can do much more for us than just fill our stomach.
Well, other questions welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about some of these specific food categories that you look at in the book, starting with meat, as you do. I think here we talked earlier, I mentioned earlier that people did have ways to preserve food, and certainly there are ways to preserve meat. But it seems that for a long time, if you had meat, it was because you raised the animal or you were close to where the animal is raised, and that people would kill the animal, slaughter it, and have a big party and eat it all up, that is because there weren't that many good ways to preserve it. But along comes Charles Tellier, the man they call in France the father of cold, a French engineer who apparently was the guy who invented the first practical industrial kind of refrigeration. And it was because he had some ideas about meat consumption, production, distribution that really broke this old pattern. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was an interesting character. And he wasn't alone. I mean, in the 19th century, in Europe and North America, which is where a lot of this story is focused, you know, the vast majority of the population would eat fresh meat only seasonally and only relatively rarely. And if anything, they were eating a lot of, they were more likely to eat salted or dried meat. And canning was also coming in the 19th century. But fresh was usually preferred. And it was, and fresh was also considered to be more healthy. And so national governments, this is particularly the case in the UK, because Britain had sort of had this longstanding association with beef as being sort of part of its national culture, were concerned in finding new sources of beef, because cattle, it's a very land-intensive industry, and There's only so many. There are only so many cattle that you can raise in the UK, and in France there was a similar concern. And so Charles Tellier was actually one of many engineers and inventors who were trying to come up with methods for being able to bring beef in a fresh state from places where they knew livestock was abundant, in particular from the, South America. And so at the time, patents being taken out for refrigeration were skyrocketing. But many of the methods were not very were either not effective or they weren't practical for putting on a steamship and for trans-equator voyages. So Charles Tellier was the first one to figure out how to do this in the 1870s, and he was so convinced that his invention was going to kind of change the world for the better and especially change France for the better, that he bought an old steamship. He retrofitted it with his refrigeration system. He filled up the ship with beef from France and sailed to Buenos Aires. And when he got there, it was like 100 days later, the meat was, in fact, still good. And there was a big onboard banquet, and all the South Americans were overjoyed because they saw the implications of this invention for their own markets, and that they would now be able to sell all this beef, which they otherwise had very little use for in Argentina and Uruguay and so forth. But the sad story with Charles Tellier is that then he returned to France and found that his own countrymen, and especially butchers, beef ranchers, and to a certain extent consumers, were not at all happy about this invention at all.
And was that because, well, for the producers, was that because of the competition?
For the producers, yes, it was. They saw the writing on the wall that they could not. They saw that the South American beef would be potentially much cheaper than theirs, and so they were concerned about the competition. Butchers were concerned because this beef was going to be coming in already slaughtered, so it would make their livelihoods potentially obsolete. Both lobbied the government to change the laws, basically to ban this imported beef, and also influenced public opinion about whether this beef was safe or edible. And there was a lot of consumer sort of distrust of refrigeration in the late 19th century, precisely because they thought that refrigeration was doing something unnatural and potentially unsafe to food.
That's an interesting idea, that people had this notion that chilling the food maybe wasn't good for it, that not only perhaps did it affect its appearance or its taste, but that it actually might be hazardous to the product.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's not as though people weren't unfamiliar with using cold to keep food longer. I mean, people had been keeping, you know, food out on window boxes and in cold cellars for a long time. But this was something different. This was a mechanical technology. It was using, you know, potentially toxic gases, ammonia, methyl chloride. And it was being done on an industrial scale as opposed to in one's own house. And so you really didn't know what was happening to the food while it was in the steamship or in the warehouse.
And there's another feature here that I think suggests that getting people to change their habits is difficult. Europeans particularly, they were in the habit of going to the market every day. You'd go to the market, you'd buy what you were going to make for dinner that night, and that's all. And that you would essentially do that every day. For them, the idea of preserving food so that you could buy a whole bunch of it at once and then use it bit by bit, that just didn't appeal to them.
No. They saw no convenience factor, certainly no taste factor in refrigeration, right? It just did not fit into their ways of life, much to the dismay of the manufacturers in the United States who were, again, by the turn of the 20th century, were looking for these foreign markets.
But in Britain and the United States, apparently, this kind of idea, particularly for people who lived in cities and far away from the centers of production, they did take to the idea.
They did. The Americans were the first to embrace the kitchen icebox and later the kitchen electric refrigerator. But the Americans, together with the British, were quick to see the value of the larger cold chain, meaning the steamships, the refrigerated rail cars. And in Britain, this is understandable because this was really sort of the first industrial nation, relatively densely populated and dependent on imported food. So they were looking to the cold chain to import not just beef, but also things like eggs, butter, and later fruits and vegetables.
Well, say in the United States, the developing of this system where you could raise the meat out in the West someplace and process it. You know, say you can raise the meat out in the West and you take the animals to Chicago and you slaughter them there and you put it onto refrigerated rail cars and then you send it out the East Coast. And so somebody in, say, New York City can go into a restaurant and sit down and eat a steak that had been produced a long, long way away.
Yes.
How did that change the way people maybe thought about food and how it is they ate?
Well, you know, initially, there was ambivalence and suspicion, and local butchers encouraged that. But the Chicago meatpackers, they persevered, again, through marketing, through fire sale prices to convince consumers to try this meat. And after a while, they decided they liked it all right. It was certainly cheap. They got used to the fact that it was a different color. And then they began to sort of expect that meat and other kinds of fresh foods would be available year-round in abundance and at an affordable price. And so one of the things that I trace in the book is the kind of the gradual and not so gradual, in some case, disappearance of seasonality in the different kind of perishable foods.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think that this is something that people talk a lot about now, the loss of seasonality, the expectation mm-hmm. that you can go down to the market and then you could find that any time of the year you can buy a strawberry or just about anything else that you want. And
right.
that there are certain prices to be paid. And some people would say quality is one of them, but it has now come to this notion that you should be able to get essentially anything that you want any time, any place.
Right. But at the time, when this was coming about, this seemed like a wonderful thing, a utopian achievement. And I think I mentioned in the book the story about the New York City diner Schraft's, which started... which in the 1930s was putting food miles on its menu, but not to encourage people to eat local, rather to boast about how far flung their fruit salads were. For example, that the ingredients of his fruit salad had traveled 16,000 miles altogether to get to that restaurant, and this seemed like great progress.
That made it somehow more special and more exotic.
Yes.
Because
yes.
the stuff had come from so far away.
Yes.
Which is now, of course, the thing that we, at least a lot of people, prize is the complete opposite. They actually would be willing to pay more money for something that had been produced close to where they were.
Yes, yes. Food. The whole significance of food miles is done an about face.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. Suzanne Friedberg is Associate Professor of Geography at Dartmouth. She's also a non-resident fellow at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University, and she is the author of a newly published book. It's titled Fresh, A Perishable History. It's published by Belknap of Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, and it looks at the idea of freshness, how it is we think about that, why it is we've come to think that it's so important, and how technology has been used to get food from where it's produced to where it's consumed quickly and at least looking good so that people will buy it. Questions or comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I suppose that gets me thinking about the idea of how much freshness really does have to do with appearance. And something, and I'm sure that people have had this experience, particularly with the produce that they might buy in the supermarket, where things that look really good, well, they're okay. That's not that it's bad, but it's not as good as it would be if they could get it where it truly was fresh, like right out of the field, or what you could do if you actually could grow it yourself.
Well, and this is not a new development. One thing that surprised me when I was doing research on the fruit chapter was how far back the marketing of beauty goes. And in 18th century France, gardening manuals are advising aristocratic gardeners to plant the beautiful varieties of peaches, even if they don't necessarily taste that good, because a certain class of consumers appreciates their beauty. But that, in the early 20th century, that became the norm and something that the California producers really latched onto because that most of their markets were in the East Coast. They couldn't be there to sell their fruit themselves. And so instead, they had to rely on the beauty of the fruit to do the selling for them. But I should add that often when we're disappointed by fruit that's beautiful but sort of bland, it's not necessarily because it's not fresh per se. Because fruit is one of those foods where freshness is not always the most important factor. It's rather ripeness and the variety of fruit and what stage of the maturation process it was picked. So when we get these peaches that look pretty in the supermarket, but then never really, they just sort of rot rather than get sweet, it's typically because they were picked too green or something. It's not because they aren't fresh, per se.
Well, and I suppose that a lot of that comes down to you want a product that will ship well, that won't get all beaten up in transit, so that then it looks good when you get to the place at the point of sale.
Right.
Something else that I learned, and I think it's interesting, I had never really thought about it. When you go into the grocery store, what's the first thing you see? Well, generally it's the produce section, and especially it's going to be the fruit. And grocers apparently discovered some time ago that if people come into the store and they see beautiful, fresh produce, especially fruit, then they will think everything else must be good.
Yes. And I actually did sort of an informal survey of calling up produce managers at supermarkets around the country because this is something that I had just sort of noticed. And I thought, well, is there any sort of science to this? And they all sort of said, well, yes, that's sort of the norm in our industry. And, you can find exceptions, but it's the norm because they found that, to quote one Whole Foods produce manager, the consumers feel like they're in nature if they see the fruit, and it sort of puts them at ease and it gets them to buy more things than they would otherwise. Not just fruit. Mm-hmm. So the fruit is kind of a lure, not like fruit has always been.
Of course, I certainly have walked in stores where the first thing that you saw was maybe a giant display of potato chips or of cola or something like that. But generally, the first regular section in the store is, in fact, the produce section.
Yes.
We have some
and
callers.
The fruit in particular.
And the fruit in particular. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. Another champagne person. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. When I shop now, it seems that everything is vacuum-packed. You can get tuna that hasn't been refrigerated. It's in a plastic bag. Is this irradiated to keep it fresh? And I gather that irradiation on food does not have to be indicated on the package. and I thought I'd ask your opinion of it. And secondly, I happened to hear on WILL, and I can't remember the year of the program, that we are still shipping dangerous pesticides to South America, which are not allowed to be used in this country, and that especially in a place like Chile, the people in Chile don't even buy their own fruit because it has it's known that the chili farmers use an enormous amount of pesticide. So I thought I would just ask your opinion on those two questions.
Okay. It's true that irradiated products do not have to be labeled in this country currently. In the case of the vacuum-packed tuna, I don't know if it – I don't think that that would need to be irradiated because the vacuum – I mean, canning is a kind of vacuum packing as well. So that the things that you're talking about is kind of a variation on canning, just in using different kinds of materials. In the case of the pesticides, unfortunately, yes, it's true that American pesticide manufacturers do export chemicals that are not used here. How much of those come back into this country is – it's a little hard to say. But because one thing that is important to keep in mind is that there's a lot of sort of private regulation in addition to government regulation. So supermarkets partly mostly in their own self-interest, they do not want to be caught with pesticide-laden products on their shelves. And so supermarkets are fairly stringent about what they'll buy. And our own government regulations are also – they're fairly stringent. They're not always the actual inspection of food coming in across our borders is not. But farmers in countries like Chile or Peru or something that are producing for export markets, they know that they have to be very careful because if something is found to be tainted with dangerous levels of pesticides, then they risk losing their entire markets. So if anything, I think those export farmers are more careful about what they sell abroad than what they sell to their own consumers in Chile, for example. So the Chilean consumers may be right in avoiding their own produce because it may be more dangerous than what comes to this country.
So I've seen things like sausage, beans, and rice in a package that isn't in the refrigerator compartment. So and those are safe to eat, even though they have meat products.
Vacuum packing is yes. I mean, I don't whether or not they can be labeled fresh is another question. I'm not sure that they actually can be again because they've been heat treated.
And in the vacuum packing, that's what you do. You treat it with heat.
Yeah, and then you suck out all the oxygen.
Okay, well, I was just a little curious about that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Right.
What an interesting show.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to talk with somebody else. This is someone in Aurora, line 4. Hello.
What a delightful, delightful subject. I didn't know there would be somebody as thrilled as I was this week. I was over at my daughter's house for lunch, and she gave me fresh beets out of the garden. And I thought, well, I must be strange or something. I raved about them all day and sent her a letter later with pickled beets recipe. I remember making pickled beets in the summer. So I want you to know there are still some people out there that love freshness. And she took me out to her garden where she had more rows of beets and zucchini coming on soon. Couple of corn plants. So I'm just delighted. And I wonder if you could tell me who can I write to at this late date in the Extension Bureau that could tell me if there's anything I can plant for this year's harvest, or is it altogether too late?
I would think that you could, whoever is your local closest extension person, they have lots and lots of information about people who want to grow vegetables and fruit and things like that at home. I think probably at this point, though, the last things that you could plant would be the cool season crops, like I'm sure that you lettuce and greens and things like that. Probably anything else is probably a little
next
bit
year.
Too late. Yeah, you would have to wait until next spring. But you could go to, you've heard Sandy on this show, Sandy Mason.
Yes,
well,
yes.
There's someone like her who should be closer to you, and that I think if you would look in the phone book and either look under your county or maybe look under University of Illinois, or you should be able to find a person like Sandy who is close to you, and they have all the same kind of access to all the same kind of information that she does, and I'm sure that they have booklets and books and all kinds of stuff about vegetable gardening in Illinois. In fact, I know there's a book, and I think that's what it's called, Vegetable Gardening in Illinois, that tells you what you can plant and when and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, you're welcome. Well, I think obviously what the caller suggests is that people do care about freshness. They like the idea of something being fresh, not just because it's pretty, but because they think that it tastes better. And that's why some people, if they can, have backyard gardens, and that's why they like to go to the farmer's market. And I think, more so than with anything else, it's going to be critical when it comes to vegetables.
Yes, and there's some vegetables where they really are best straight out of the garden or only a few hours old. And, sweet corn is one of those crops you see showing up at the farmer's market, and the farmers are always, they have these signs up saying picked at 8 this morning or something. Mm-hmm. And in the case of sweet corn, it really makes a difference because that sugar turns quickly to starch. So a few hours old is definitely best. But in the case of fruits, which includes tomatoes, they're actually better when they aren't quite so fresh, when they've had, been able to sit on your windowsill for a few days.
Something else, another of the things that you talk about here that I want to make sure we talk a little bit about, because I think it's an interesting example of the way a lot of things, technology, marketing, expectations, all sort of come together, and that's the egg.
Yes.
And here was another case where people really had to be persuaded that cold storage was okay. But just going back to the basic point, and again, this is something, not being a farm boy, I would not have known this, that chickens do not, under normal circumstances, do not lay eggs year-round. And if you're going to have an egg industry, though, you got to have a year-round supply of eggs. And one of the things that egg producers worked on early on was trying to figure out, okay, what can we do with these chickens to get them to lay eggs year-round? And they found a way.
They did, yes. The story of the egg was an interesting one because I found that very few people knew that eggs were traditionally a seasonal crop, as it were. And that's because chickens, hens, are, like most birds, are very sensitive to changes in temperature and daylight. And traditionally, when spring rolled around, the days got longer and the weather a little warmer, that was a sign that it was time to lay their eggs, which made evolutionary sense because chicks that hatched in spring and summer would have the best chance of surviving. Farmers had known for centuries that they could tinker with things a little bit, that some varieties of chickens were more likely to lay a few eggs in fall or winter than others, that if you kept the hen house warm, if you fed them a very rich diet, they could be convinced to lay a few eggs off season. But the vast majority of eggs up through the early 20th century were laid in the springtime, and that's when people ate the most eggs at, Easter, Passover. And the rest of the year, they had a variety of what would seem to us very strange methods for preserving eggs. But the rest of the year, they didn't eat as many. And that's why they were cold stored in such large quantities, because they were so seasonal. But they could also be kept potentially for months if you kept them at a low temperature and they were in good shape. But the really breakthrough technology was, in fact, the light bulb, because farmers found that if they kept the lights on in the hen house, that hens really didn't know the difference between January and May, and that they could be convinced to just keep laying.
Just you just touched on something. Also, one of the other things that I learned that I didn't know is that eggs apparently actually can keep for a very long time, as you say, provided that you do certain things.
Yeah, and I was sort of flabbergasted when I was reading these old sort of cookery manuals from the mid-19th century with sort of advice about how to keep eggs, quote-unquote, fresh for up to 2 years. And there are these methods like varnishing the eggs and then putting them in sawdust and putting them in these in what's called glass water. It's kind of the sodium silicate solution. And so people had these methods that they claimed could keep – they were not talking about pickling of eggs – that could keep eggs in a more or less fresh state, maybe not something you would want to eat sunny side up, but perfectly good for cooking for several months. And people routinely ate eggs that were laid in April in December.
Hmm. Well, before we get to the point where you have the refrigeration and then you have the advances in production that – get you year-round eggs, and then you have ways to ship them. Would people who lived in, say, metropolitan areas, unless, of course, they raised chickens, and maybe some people did, would people have had much experience with eggs?
Seasonally, they would have, yeah. But again, they would be much likely to eat. They would eat many fewer eggs during the off season, and so. When industrial-scale cold storage came about at the turn of the century, eggs were a major commodity for cold storage, because they were seasonal, and it was very attractive to warehousemen to buy up eggs by the millions in the spring when they were very cheap and put them in these warehouses to sell for a higher price in the fall and winter. But this was a very controversial practice, because consumers felt that the warehousemen were hoarding and manipulating a market that warehousemen argued that they were doing a service to consumers because they were making this sort of staple food available year round at an affordable price, but consumers saw it as both unnatural and immoral to be tinkering with this market. And legislation to regulate cold storage and put limits on how long goods could be stored were passed in several cities and states, including Chicago, and a bill actually reached the U.S. Senate, but it never actually passed, and that was in 1910.
Well, and did any of that, though, have to do with people's concerns about what it was doing to the egg for it to be in cold storage for a long time?
Well, there were sort of two issues, and they tended to get sort of conflated. There's the issue of freshness and fairness. Mm-hmm. Consumers were concerned because they were always early cold storage did not always work that well, and so there were stories of products that had been stored that came out rotten. But it was also cold storage was often abused by merchants, especially with eggs, because again, you can't tell just by looking at them if they're good or not. Merchants of putting food that was either sort of going bad to begin with, like beef or fish or something, into cold storage, or in the case of eggs, just not the one way to tell if eggs are good without cracking them open is to candle them. In other words, to hold them up to a bright light. And instead of candling them before storing them, they would just put the eggs into storage and then sell them off. And whatever retailer or consumer ended up with the bad eggs, it was considered sort of their fault, sort of the buyer beware. And so that kind of industry practice got cold storage eggs a bad reputation early on. So there were concerns about freshness, but there was also if eggs were good to begin with and properly stored, they could in fact keep for months. And there were a lot of people in the USDA, for example, that went to a lot of trouble to convince consumers of that.
We have about 6-7 minutes left. Just want to introduce one more time quickly our guest, Suzanne Friedberg. She is Associate Professor of Geography at Dartmouth College and also non-resident fellow at Harvard University at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. And she is the author of the book Fresh, A Perishable History. It's just recently come out. We have maybe 5-7 minutes left. Somebody wants to call real quick, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to return to vegetables, what people maybe don't appreciate is that I think probably both fruit and vegetables, to grow them, pick them, process them, this is very labor intensive. And yet at the same time, we have this idea, and it's a notion I'm sure that the distributors have promoted, that somehow fresh foods, especially vegetables, come straight from nature. And somehow there's this just idea that all you have to do is reach up to the tree and just pick it off, or bend over and pick up the vegetable, pick your tomato off the plant, and that's it. And that there wasn't really this appreciation for just how much labor it took and how the demand for labor must have expanded as these industries expanded and people figured out how they could grow something in California and then send it to, oh, let's say, Chicago or New York City.
Yes. And early vegetable growers in California, yes, they did. They advertised their products as being natural. In case of iceberg lettuce, they advertised it as being a sun food. There were never any images of labor shown. But they also talked, even though these were really sort of industrial-scale farmers and using, you know, power tractors and so forth, they emphasized that because these were natural products, that they should not be held to the kind of labor laws that regulate other kinds of industries, that they were somehow different. And to this day, agricultural labor is not protected by the same laws as other industries, and that's the result of you know, generations of marketing, excuse me, of lobbying, and as most people know, much of the labor supply in this country in the fresh fruit and vegetable industries is coming from abroad, and that is again also something that producers lobbied to make sure was available.
Let's get one more caller here, at least in the time that remains. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I heard you talking about cold storage, and I had a question about apples. Mm-hmm. Is it true that a lot of produce, I mean, unless you go to an apple orchard and pick your own apples, that some of the apples you're buying in the stores have been in cold storage?
Yeah, it depends on the season, mm-hmm. Because, yeah. Most of the fall, in the fall, they're likely to be fresh. But if you're buying apples at this time of year, depending on where they're coming from, the chances are good that they have been stored. But some apples store quite well, actually.
Okay. Well, is it refrigerated cold storage or just a cave somewhere? I mean, is it, you know, what kind of cold storage is it?
Well, apple orchards often have cold storage, like, you know, barn-size cold storage, which combines low temperatures and controlled atmosphere. They found that if they control the nitrogen and oxygen levels, that adds to the preservation powers of cold.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank
you. Sure.
We are coming down to the point we have here just a couple of minutes left. And there are some things we won't get to, so people want to read more. They should go out and look for fresh. But I want to come down to this to the idea of how it is, or to talk about how it is that this changed the American, particularly in the United States, but I'm sure all around the world, it changed our diet. It changed what people ate.
Yes, tremendously. People started in the early part of the 20th century. People started eating more fresh fruits and vegetables. They started drinking much more milk, eating more eggs, eating more fresh meat. And so, in a lot of ways, refrigeration did improve our diet. And these days, lots of people are sort of nostalgic for the days when everything was local and seasonal. But these changes in for a lot of people allowed them to eat better. And again, this is why refrigeration was seen to be something of a utopian technology.
At what point did people start to become more and more aware about the nutritional aspects of food, things like vitamins, for example? And did how does that dovetail with notions of freshness?
Vitamins were discovered in the 19-teens and really started to enter sort of, you know, popular culture in the 1920s. And that did have that was another factor that I talk about in the book, is that vitamins, they were thought, people didn't understand them very well at that time, but they knew that they were somehow important. And foods that contained a lot of vitamins were called protective. Fresh fruits, vegetables, milk were all known as protective foods because they were thought to protect people against an otherwise fairly increasingly refined food supply. So there was quite a major shift in between the turn of the century and like the 1920s. From nutritionists recommending that people just eat a lot of meat and wheat to telling that people that they really needed to have a more balanced and fresher diet in order to get more of these sort of micronutrients known as vitamins.
Mm-hmm. Well, just you wonder, I think about an earlier caller, whether we have become so preoccupied with the medicinal in a sense, the medicinal aspects of foods. You know, we talk about functional foods. My joke always is, well, the function of food is to keep you alive. It all has that function. But that we're thinking a lot about that, and I wonder if sometimes that doesn't trump our interest in something that tastes good. And in the past, maybe freshness had something to do with taste, and of course you don't want something that's spoiled, but that we're thinking more and more about the food product as a collection of chemical components, and some of them are good for us and maybe some of them not, and that sometimes gets in the way of appreciating the fact that sometimes we just eat it because it tastes really good.
Yes, I know. And again, people are often, I think most people are rarely purists, and they're contradictory in some ways, so that on one hand that they will, you know, worry that they're not getting the complete all their vitamins and micronutrients, and they pay enormous amount of attention to labels, and then, you know, go out and have an ice cream, whatever, and I'm the same way, of course, but but they're at the same time, there are now these days all kinds of forces telling us that we should eat because things taste good. So I wouldn't say that we've gotten away from this fixation on food as medicine by any means, because, again, there's lots of advertising around it, but there's more than one message out there.
So how does this come to be something that a geographer would be interested in?
Well, fortunately, geographers can look at almost anything on the face of the earth and call it geography. But it is very geographic in that with the invention of refrigeration and improved transportation, sort of the whole geography of food supply was revolutionized. So, and also people's ideas about what foods can be or should be grown and from where. So it's actually very geographic.
Well, we are going to have to stop there. We're here at the end of the time. For folks who want to read more on the subject, and more than certainly we have discussed here, the book to look for is titled Fresh, A Perishable History by our guest, Suzanne Friedberg. She's Associate Professor of Geography at Dartmouth, a non-resident fellow at Harvard University at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. She's speaking to us from there. We want to say thanks to the engineer there, Evan Whitney, and to you, Professor Friedberg. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives, first produced and presented in 2009. More shows available at our website, will.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn works with family and friends to create a plan to support residents' health and independence and provide them with a sense of belonging. More information is available at 384-0100. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Compañía Flamenco José Porcel in a sensational evening of dance on Thursday, November 17th. More information is at CranertCenter.com.
Up next, an update on the commodity markets.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
And in a minute before 11 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert with this look at the markets at this hour. In Kansas City, hard red winter wheat for December. Right now, it's 6.95 3/4, down 8 1/4. December wheat from Chicago, 6.11 1/4, down 5 1/2. March, 6.35 1/4, down 10 3/4. December corn, 6.32, down 6 1/2. March, 6.41 1/4, down 6 1/2. May, 6.47 3/4, down 6 3/4. November beans, 11.70 up 4. January beans, 11.78 1/4, up 2 3/4. March, 11.88